Super excited for this edition of Catching Up with Simo and Shep. We have one of the best tigers of all time. Lance Parrish joins us to talk about his book, The Enchanted Season, 1984, and a whole lot more. It's coming up next on Catching Up with Simo and Shep, right after this. Glad you're with us, everybody, this week. It is an honor. Look, he's a friend of ours for sure and has been for a long time, but in front of a live studio audience, we are talking with the great Lance Parrish. Boy, it's great to see you. How are you?
I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, come on, man.
I would go that far.
I would argue this. I've gone over this. I'm a little bit probably too passionate about Tigers of the past and whether or not they belong in the Hall of Fame. Lou Whitaker, Mickey Lolich. I have made the case for you. Have you? What was your thought process when you first retired about your credentials as a Hall of Famer?
Well, before I answer that, God bless you for saying what you just said. And, you know, to be very honest with you, Shep, I never even gave it a second thought. That's really not something that I actually think about.
Okay.
I enjoyed playing the game. If I had a great year, or I had a great game, or I contributed, I was happy. Mm-hmm. Never really thought about if I was going to make the All-Star team or I was going to win this or that, or even if I was going to make it to the Hall of Fame. So I feel like I had a pretty solid career for the most part, and I'm good with that.
I knew you would say that, knowing how humble you are. So I made sure I did the research, all right? Your WAR, wins above replacement, is better than three Hall of Famers. It's better than JT Realmuto, and it's better than Salvador Perez. Your home runs of 324 are better than 14 of the 18 Hall of Fame catchers. And when you retired, you were fourth all-time in home runs for catchers. Your RBIs are better than nine catchers that are in the Hall of Fame. Your slugging percentage is better than six in the Hall of Fame, and your runs scored are better than six in the Hall of Fame. I'm making your case. Well, I know you wouldn't do it for yourself.
You should be in the Hall of Fame.
You can make the argument. No, you should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, hey, it's good to be in the argument.
Okay.
As long as I'm in the conversation, I'm good with that.
All right. That's a beautiful thing.
Well, take me to that 84 team. And we talk a lot about it. I've heard a lot about it, obviously, when you were our bullpen coach in 2003.
Right.
And we admired you guys. We looked up to you guys, obviously. Take me through that season. What was it like going to the ballpark every day?
Well, if you could dream of a season that you would like to be a part of, that would have been it. I mean, it was amazing from start to finish. I can't really say that coming out of spring training, I thought we were going to get off to the start that we got off to.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a good 83 season, mm-hmm. which is what I assume everybody felt was a catalyst for us. That, we just couldn't catch them dang Orioles, but we had a solid year. And with the few changes we had made going into 84, you know, we thought, you know, we should be a little bit stronger. I was honestly disappointed with some of the guys that we cut loose. You know, Glenn Wilson got let go. John Walkenfuss got let go. They brought in guys like Dave Bergman and Willie Hernandez, who I didn't even know who they were, you know, because back then they were National Leaguers. We never saw them.
Sure.
So I didn't remember either one of them. But they certainly stepped up and made huge contributions. We signed our first big free agent in Darrell Evans, and I'm sure he will say that he didn't have the kind of year that he was hoping to have, but his contribution went well beyond what he did on the field. The leadership qualities that he had in the clubhouse was something that we needed, that we were lacking. A veteran guy, a veteran voice, Dave Bergman, same way. So those guys, whatever contribution they made on the field paled in comparison to what they made in the clubhouse and in igniting a fire under us, you know, to try to keep us motivated throughout the course. They knew that we were going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really know how good we could be. So all of a sudden we started out 35-5 and it was like, wow. I mean, I don't think anybody could believe that.
It's still, you know, incredible.
I don't know if it'll ever be done again.
I think winning your first 17 road games is almost as impressive as the 35-5 start.
Oh, absolutely, without question.
Yeah, you mentioned Bergman and you mentioned Darrell Evans. What did they do in the clubhouse that you needed and that you learned from the most, do you think?
Well, we had a, how can I put this constructively?
You can say whatever you want because we're on YouTube.
We had a little a wild hair going through our clubhouse.
We'll call it a wild hair, right?
Wild hair. And, you know, I mean, very talented guys.
Yeah.
But we were just, you know, we were not refined at that point. We were a little, you know, rough around the edges. You know, those guys came in and helped to shape and mold us, along with Sparky and the coaches, and trying to get, you know, us focused in how good we actually could be, reminding us of situational play. Here's the things you need to do, things you need to be aware of. And I think early on, they saw how good we could be. So they, I think, maybe stepped up in the area of holding us accountable for taking care of ourselves and, you know, getting our rest as best we could. I mean, obviously, a lot of young guys, you know, we get on the road and everybody would, you know, hit the street, so to speak. But but I think when we realized we had something really good going, I think everybody started to, you know, refocus. Hey, you know, and then we started holding each other accountable. You know, you better get your butt in bed and you better do this, you better do that. We got a big game tomorrow. So I think we realized that this is going to be our chance to do something special. And obviously we were able to do that.
So you believe in chemistry?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, you talk about the game today. Everybody talks about, you know, it's not about chemistry. You got to want to go to the ballpark, right? It's important to go to the ballpark and
band of brothers mentality.
That's what it is.
You know what I mean? You want to, you know, you sacrifice for one another, you play for one another, you pull for one another, hold each other accountable. Right. I mean, you live with each other for, you know, longer than you live with your families during the season. So, you know, it's a family atmosphere. And, you know, when you develop a winning attitude, I think it gets contagious. I think Sparky saw that early on and didn't want to let it go. Kept reminding us of it. You know, hey, we got something good going here. Don't screw it up, kind of thing.
The amazing thing about that team, you led the league or led the team in homers with 33.
Right.
You led the team in RBIs with 98. Right. So nobody hit more than the 33. Nobody drove in 100 runs. Right. No pitcher won 20 games, and only one player hit 300. It really was the ultimate
very balanced
team. Yeah, very balanced, wasn't it?
And everybody was, you know, even our bench guys, they accepted their role, which was great, and they were prepared. That was another thing, you know. You're going to get called on to do a job, be ready to do it, kind of a thing, you know. And more times than not, when they got called on to do something, they came through. That's what really made us a solid ball club. So, you know, I've always said, with all the contributions that everybody made, in my opinion, the one guy that doesn't get enough credit is Aurelio Lopez.
Yeah.
You know, Aurelio Lopez got kind of kicked to the curb for Willie Hernandez that year, so Willie could become the closer. Aurelio was our closer, and all he did was go out and I think he went like 10-1 with 15 saves and a 2-something ERA. He was Willie's setup guy. But every time they put him in, and he was a workhorse, you know. Sparky'd call on him to pitch 1 inning, 2 innings, you know, 2+ innings, and he'd step up every time and do. He had a rubber arm, but you know, and he was good. So
how was that dynamic? I got a question for you about this. How about that dynamic between Trammell and Lou Whitaker up the middle? Can you describe some of the plays they made, some of the things that you witnessed being the catcher, getting the best view of all of it?
And you're right. I mean, I did have the best view.
Best view.
And you know, I found myself just, you know, an attempt to answer that question with this response. I tried to call a game so that hopefully I would get a ground ball to either one of them because I knew they'd always make the play.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. I mean, I obviously watched the hitter, but, you know, if I felt that we could get in on somebody and he'd, you know, jam himself or roll over the top and hit a ball to short or to second, that was my objective. Hit the ball to Lou or Allen.
That's cool.
You know, and a lot of times it worked out that way, so.
April 7th, no one got a hit off Jack Morris. You were behind the dish. He had 8 strikeouts, and he threw a no-hitter. Right. He also walked 6 in that game.
Sorry?
Walked 6 batters.
I know.
Now, people forget, that was the fourth game of the year.
Yeah.
Was there any, I can't believe this is happening so early, and this is a sign, or what do you remember most about that game at Comiskey Park, which was an absolute trash can?
Well, I think it was early enough that that it was an absolute what?
That place is an absolute trash can.
Well, yeah, it was.
Tell me how you really feel. Is that how you feel? Damn.
But I think it was early enough in the season that, you know, we really hadn't done anything. We won our first however many games, and we were on the first national TV game. Jack throws a no-hitter. I will say Durwood didn't have his best game behind the plate. I wanted to turn around and smack him a few times. I mean, Jack was putting the ball right there, and he kept, you know, squeezing him and you know, might not have been responsible for all the walks, but I really did feel like Durwood was squeezing him, especially at the end. I thought he had Kittle struck out, you know, the pitch before he actually struck him out, you know, that sealed the deal. But along with those walks, I don't know if you remember that Jack had the bases loaded in the game with nobody out.
Yeah.
You know, and still was able to get out of that and still pitch a no-hitter. So it was, you know, and that might even be more impressive than just mowing through everybody all the way. Although we did have a game like that the year before with Wilcox in Chicago against the White Sox, had a perfect game for 8 2/3.
That's right.
And then he shook me off and ruined the whole deal.
That was Jerry Harrison.
I had to mention that. Was
that Jerry Harrison? Never let him forget that.
He shook you off, right?
Was that the Jerry Harrison
just
hit?
Just throw what I put
down.
Yeah,
Jerry Harrison hit it. Yeah.
Where are we going next?
I was going to stay on it just for a little bit.
Because I love that he can recall this.
I know.
And so I'm over here sitting here like kind of in awe too. I mean, I'm like.
It's fresh on my memory.
Listen to me. Yeah.
Well, the book is fantastic.
Talk to me a little bit about the book too. Tell me what inspired the book. Have you always?
Well, you know, it became an idea because this last year was our 40th anniversary. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the concept of the book and reliving the 84 season came up, and I was approached. Tom Gage was approached. Do you guys have any interest in doing this? We think it'd be a great idea. I was like, you know, I'll do it. You know, but the interesting thing is I didn't really want to put anything. You know, maybe it's just my stupidity, I guess, for lack of a better word, of thinking that I could participate in writing a book and not say anything about myself. You know, because Tom was like, Lance, you got to say something about yourself and your early career and all that, because you're the guy writing the book, you know, and people would like to know some of that. So I go, yeah, okay, I get it. So actually, it gave me an opportunity to relive a lot of the things that happened right after I signed and went to my first year in the minor leagues, which was kind of crazy in itself. I've always been amazed in retrospect that I actually made it to the big leagues. I mean, I didn't start off very well. You know, I figured I was on my way out. And I've said over and over, If I would have been playing in today's game with the people running our organization, the way things they operate now, well, the way everybody operates, I had three horrible years. They probably would have kicked me out, you know, well before I ever got an opportunity to accomplish anything. But it was that fourth year when I got with Les Moss in AAA. And the other thing was they kept moving me up every year. Didn't matter what I did.
Why was that?
Yeah, I would say you're a high-round pick.
I was a number one pick.
So that
was my ticket, obviously.
That was your ticket.
You know,
yeah.
And
so
they
you think
saw
if you would have
ability.
Been like an eighth round pick, something would have been different.
Oh, like I was?
Yeah.
I stayed the same damn league 3 years in a row.
I will say this, and I actually covered it in the book, Tom and I did.
Yeah.
I mentioned to him that, you know, they signed me as a third baseman. And I played a little bit of third base in high school, my senior year. Because we didn't have anybody to play. Our third baseman was hurt. So they threw me over there for a while. And I assumed that that's when the Tigers came to watch me when I was playing third base. Maybe I had a good game or two. I don't know. But when the scout came to my house and said, we want you to play third base, I was like, you're kidding me. I mean, I had caught from the time I was in Little League all the way through high school, and I pitched. And I was a pretty good pitcher, even though I didn't have a great repertoire. I had a fastball slider, and I could throw hard so that, you know, I had a little bit of success that way. But when they told me they wanted me to play third, I was like, wow, okay, well, I guess you guys know best. I'll play third. So when I went to rookie ball, I played third base. Mark Fidrich was on that team, and we had a great rookie league team. Played a 70-game schedule. We had one game rained out that we never made up, so our record was 52-17. We just kicked butt. We ran right through the league.
Wow.
Had a great season. And then we all got moved up to Lakeland, which was high A then, and before I got to Lakeland in instructional ball, after our rookie season was over, Hoot Evers, our farm director, calls me in the office and he says, so here's what we're thinking. We're going to move you to catcher. And I'm like, cool. It's where I should have been to begin with, even though I did make the All-Star team in my rookie year, the Appalachian League All-Star. Don't ask me how I did that. So anyway, we're going to make you catcher, and we want you to switch hit. And I'm like, switch hit? I go, I've never switched hit before. And he said, look it, we've talked about it. With that short porch in right field in Detroit, if you ever get the hang of this, there's no telling how many home runs you'd hit. And I go, but I've never switched hit before.
Yeah.
You know? And I just turned 18. I was kind of a late 18. I turned 18 in June, the year that I was drafted, after my senior year. Okay. So I basically was just getting rolling into my 18th year. And it was like, okay, they signed me as a third baseman. They moved me to catcher and they told me they wanted me to switch hit. And I'm just like,
whoa. How long did that experiment last?
1 year. And the irony in that, again, is that they sent me to Lakeland. My manager was a guy by the name of Stubby Overmeyer. Stubby Overmeyer was a left-handed pitcher that actually made it to the big leagues, and he was like that tall. So he came by that name, you know, legitimately. Great guy, but, you know, I don't really know how much he knew about hitting, okay? Mm-hmm. And we had one other coach, because back then we didn't have a whole bunch of coaches. One guy. And he was another pitcher. Mike Dwyer was his name. He was our other coach. So it was like they send me to A-ball, and I don't have a hitting coach. And they tell me they want me to switch hit. And I'm like, dude, you know? So, I mean, okay, they got the short porch in right field in Detroit, but for the first half of the season, I couldn't even pull the ball. I mean, all I was trying to do is just make contact, hitting the ball the other way, hitting it up the middle. I don't think I ever did hit a home run left-handed the whole year.
So this wasn't just practicing in the cave. You know how we practice in the cave,
all year.
This was in the during the game. You don't have to switch.
Man.
Oh, no.
That's crazy.
That is crazy to even think
about. And, you know, the funny thing is I recall when I was managing in West Michigan a few years back, and farm director, Dave Littlefield, was in town, and we were sitting around. He's asking me stories about my career, and I tell him this story, and he just started laughing. And I go, what's so funny? He says, well, I'm the farm director here. He goes, you know what would happen to me if I did that to our number one draft pick? He goes, they'd fire me tomorrow, today maybe.
Think about that. They would.
That is especially the latter part where he has no hitting instructor. That makes absolutely,
no sense at all.
What I love most about the book, I don't know if people, I do want to get to Les Moss here in a moment. But what I love about the book is I think some people forget you were a hell of a football player. You could have gone and played college football.
I could have.
Right? Was it UCLA?
Well, I signed to go to UCLA.
Yeah. As a
quarterback. I mean, in retrospect, I might have changed my mind on that. You know, yeah. UCLA never won anything.
Yeah.
But I was won over by their coaching. Dick Vermeil was the head football coach then. You know, so even though.
How great is that?
Yeah.
A Super Bowl winning football coach who actually led two teams to the Super Bowl would have been your coach at UCLA, and you would have been his quarterback. Right.
Yeah. I wanted to play quarterback. So that was kind of the deal. And I was going to be on a football scholarship, and they were going to let me play baseball. That was the big, you know, if you don't let me play baseball, I'm not coming here. You know, I have to play baseball kind of a thing. So I went on recruiting trips to UCLA, USC, Nebraska, Arizona State, and I went to Cal Berkeley. And I tell this story all the time, but, you know, not the – bag on Cal Berkeley, but that wasn't real high on my list. But the guy that was recruiting me was the nicest, greatest guy ever, you know, and he was always down at my school and he was, you know, had the greatest personality, always telling jokes. When he wasn't at my school, he used to send me cards to my house, you know. I mean,
he really wanted me
to go there. And so Mike White was the head football coach at Cal Berkeley back then, and Jackie Jensen was the head baseball coach. And lo and behold, I didn't know this at the time. I don't think anybody did because they were both in college. But they had two quarterbacks at the time when I was being recruited, one of which was Vince Ferragamo, who ended up being the quarterback for the Rams. Yep. And the other one was Steve Bartkowski.
For the Falcons.
Yeah. So they both.
He could spin it.
He could spin it.
Yeah, he could spin it.
So, I mean, they were the two quarterbacks they had. And Ferragamo could not beat out Bartkowski. So he transferred to Nebraska. So I'm thinking, you know, here I am going to go in and play quarterback. Well, I might never sniff the field with, you know, the guys that they had ahead of me. So, you know, it was that. And I'll tell you a great story. So when Cal Berkeley was recruiting me, they were coming down to Southern Cal, where I lived, to play the Trojans, USC, in the Coliseum, okay? They played on a Saturday, and we had a Friday night football game, our high school football game. So they contacted our athletic department, our head football coach, and asked if they could have permission, since they were in town anyway, to have their marching band play at halftime at our high school game. Hmm. And I, you know, and they told me that, and I'm like, well, why would they do that? Well, he goes, well, you dummy, they're trying to impress you.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And I go, well, I'm not even going to get to see him. I'm going to be in the locker room, you know?
Right.
So anyway, we play the first half and we go in the locker room, right? So all of a sudden out of the eastern end zone or whatever, here comes this marching band that filled up the entire football field. And they're going through all their motions and, you know, in and out and all. And my dad had brought a guy that was a really good friend of his growing up. He was in town to watch this football game. So they're sitting up there in the stands watching, and they're watching this band just going, you know, wild on the field. And finally, my dad's buddy looks over to him and says, you know what? He goes, this has got to be the greatest high school band I've ever seen in my life. So my dad got a big kick out of that. But it was, I mean, it was a great gesture. And, yeah. You know, they went on and, you know, obviously played USC. I'm sure they lost because USC was great back then.
Yeah.
You know, John McKay, I could have played for John McKay.
Wow.
And, you know.
What was your favorite sport, though? What was it? Was your baseball? Was that your favorite sport?
Well, when it came down to it.
Baseball wasn't my favorite sport.
When it came, I mean, I love football.
I love football.
But I'll tell you this, you know, you being a football player. When I went on these recruiting trips, I got to go to two different, I got to see all the football guys and everything. But when I went to Nebraska was playing Kansas. You know, at Nebraska. And they had a red out or a white out or whatever. I mean, the whole stadium was just decked in red and white. And I was on the sidelines, and I'm watching these guys that are like big as houses just crushing each other. And I'm standing there going, man, do I really want to do this?
And look how, I mean, big but wheel.
He's a big wheel. I know, that's crazy.
Well, you know, back then I'm a senior in high school.
Yeah.
And then I went to UCLA, same deal. They were going to play their spring game. And I stood next to the locker room door when everybody came out, run out on the field for their spring game. And that year they had the biggest line in the nation. That's the way they were advertised. And I'm watching these guys coming out of this locker room, and it was like, boom, boom, boom. You know, they're all giants, you know, massive dudes. And I'm thinking, and same thing, standing on the sideline, they're crushing each other. And I'm just going, wow.
I think one of the coolest things is that you were born in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
You moved to California, I think, when you were six.
Yeah, on my sixth birthday.
On your sixth birthday, you get, you know, obviously drafted by the Tigers. You play for the Tigers. Later on in your career, you play for California, yep. Which was not now the LA Angels, California Angels. And you played for Pittsburgh for a period of time. So you kind of ran that gamut.
Which was very cool because I still have relatives there, and they got to come and watch me play. So, I mean, the circumstance wasn't the best. I was just trying to hang on.
That's kind of fulfilling, though, don't you think?
Oh, I mean,
to be able to do all those.
Yeah. Well, I got to play back home in California, Anaheim Stadium, and then I got to play in Pittsburgh, where all my family's from. So it was a pretty special deal.
I do remember when you left Detroit. You and I have talked about this before. I was pretty emotional. My family was emotional. I remember,
so was I.
Yeah, I know. It bothers me to this day. My father, I remember, saw you at a post office in Farmington Hills, came home and said, I just saw Lance Parrish. My brother and I stand up. Did you get his autograph? And my dad looked at us. He says, hell no, I didn't get his autograph. The man's got the day off. You don't bother an athlete when he's got the day off. You let him be. I shook his hand and said, thanks for all that you do. But when you left Detroit and it was over, you know, the team was such a, what a cheap ass way to go about things. But it really bothered me. How much did it bother you? And when you played for the Tigers, was it one of those things where you envisioned, this is where I want to play my entire career?
Well, I absolutely did. And it was devastating, to be honest with you. I thought that I had done everything I could do to reinforce my position on the team. I mean, I wanted to be a part of the Detroit Tigers for as long as I played professional baseball. That's just kind of the way it was. You know, I felt a part of that family with Gibby and Tram and Jack and Lou and Chet and Larry Herndon and all those guys, man. It was we were a unit. I felt very close bond to all of them. And, you know, when this whole collusion thing came down, that's kind of what killed the whole deal. I was coming off a 6-year contract, was actually negotiated. Campbell wanted to sign me for 7 years. And, you know, the story behind that is I pulled in the parking lot one afternoon to come to the, you know, for the game. I got there early, and he instructed the parking lot attendant, when Parrish comes in here, send him up to my office. I want to talk to him. So I go up there and I sit down in front of him, and he reaches in his desk and flops down a stack of papers on the desk. And I go, "What's that?" He goes, "Well, look at it." Just the way Campbell was. "Look at it." And I'm looking at it and I go, "Oh, it looks like a contract." And he goes, "Well, it is a contract." And he goes, "You know, we are prepared to offer you a 7-year deal for da 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 money, you know?" And I'm thinking, wow, that's like more money than
you could ever imagine.
And but then all of a sudden I'm going, "Well, I have an agent, you know. I'm sure this is gonna sit real well with him if I just, you know, say, okay, I'll do it and sign my name on the contract." So, you know, he's telling me, you know, "I've already offered this contract to a couple other guys and they've accepted it, and I'm offering it to you." And I go, and I just go, "Jim," I go, "I can't sign that." You know, and just, I mean, as soon as you cross that line, it's like, you know, his hair stands up. Well, he didn't have any hair.
I was just going to say.
If he had any hair, it would have stood up. And he goes, "What do you mean you can't sign it? And I said, "Well," I go, I have an agent. I go, "I just can't, you know, push him aside and do this behind his back." I said, "You know, I would need to sit down and talk with him and let him be a part of this." And he goes, "Well, let me tell you something." He goes, "If you make him a part of this, all you're going to end up doing is giving him a percentage of what you're going to get, because you're not getting any more than what's in that contract." He says, "So I'm telling you right now, it's a very fair offer. I'm advising you to sign it and keep your agent out of it and keep all the money for yourself." And I go, "I can't do that, you know?" And he just started yelling at me and getting on me. And I'm just like, wow.
This is before a game, too.
Right, before a game.
So I just said, "Can't do it." I said, "But I will go home, talk to my wife and my agent, and I'll get back to you." You know, so I guess he ran out of things to say. And he goes, "All right, get out of here then."
So that's when he went from a 7-year to a 6-year deal?
Well, so, yeah, he negotiated it down, same amount of money from 7 years to 6 years. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, he goes, "Oh, it's, you know, where you're at right now in your career, it's a pretty good deal, so I would do it. And you still have an opportunity. If you produce at the end of these 6 years, you'll have another chance to go." And so, So fast forward 6 years, I'm coming off my last year on this contract. I always compared myself to Gary Carter in the National League, because we had similar statistics, same amount of All-Star, you know, the whole nine yards. And early on, Campbell always told me, the way this negotiation thing works, it's we compare your numbers to people that are similar to what, you know, you have accomplished and what they're making, blah, blah, blah. And I go, okay, fair enough. So now all of a sudden, I'm at the end of my contract, and Gary Carter's making like three times what I'm making, right, or more. So I'm thinking, okay, I've honored this contract. I've never said I want to renegotiate or I want more money. And I was productive. You know, I had made All-Star teams. The only bad thing that happened was that year in 1986, I hurt my back. I had a broken pedicle in my back and my backbone. And I played for the whole first half of the season. My back was killing me. But I still had the best production numbers I had in my career up to that point. Wow. I had 21 home runs and 60-something RBIs at the All-Star break. Batted cleanup in the All-Star game, da-da-da-da. And then a week after the All-Star break, I couldn't get out of bed. My back just locked up, and I was, like, out. I was done. So fast forward, and I flew out to California to see, Dr. Robert Watkins, the back specialist that the Jerlin, the Job Curlin Clinic. Got my words combined.
That's
there.
A tough one to say. Yeah.
And, you know, he did all of his work up on me and said, you know, you have this break in there and I could go in and do surgery and put a little pin and screws and all that. And I go, then do it. And he goes, but here's the deal. He says, you're still a young man in the middle of your career. He says, I'm not going to say that it would happen, but if by chance, when I got in there, I nicked a nerve, he goes, your career would be over with. I go, well, then don't do it. I don't want to go there. So anyway, the other alternative that was rehab. So I spent hours at Henry Ford Rehab Center, you know, swimming in the arthritic pool and, you know, stretching and doing ab work. And I had the whole objective was to stabilize my spine, my core. You know, if you can strengthen the muscles around your spine, that will hold everything in place because you've got too much play in there right now because you have that broken bone. So I'm like, okay, so I did it, man. I worked my butt off. And then at the end of the year, with the thanks that I get is that we're going to offer you a one-year deal for the same amount of money you made last year. And, you know, the thing was, in spring training of 86, my agent and Campbell had and LaJoy had sat down and worked on an extension that would have taken me well beyond, you know, a number of years. Yeah. And it was agreed to. My agent was all fired up. All it needed was my signature, right? And right before I was able to get my signature on that contract, they pulled it off the table and said, we're not going to negotiate with you now until the end of the season. And there was never no, there was no reason for it. It's just we've made the decision to pull this off the table and wait till the end of the year. Well, what had happened was the whole collusion thing kicked in.
Collusion happened, right.
So, you know, and you know, of all the times to have something happen to me physically, it happened, you know, but I still had a good year.
Yeah. So
I mean,
what a ruthless.
I mean, I put my numbers against everybody in the American League. I had better numbers than most of the guys that caught the whole year.
Hell yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's what I threw out at Jim Campbell. I said, you're not going to offer me a $1 raise? And I said, I have better numbers than just about every catcher.
Sure.
And he goes, well, this is what we're offering. You take it or leave it. And I was like, man. So I was extremely disappointed. So the answer to that question after all this is that I didn't want to go anywhere. I wanted to be a Tiger my whole life, you know. You know, everybody goes, "Oh, I can't believe that you know that you left or whatever." I go, "Why?" You know, it's like I didn't want to leave.
You got to go through it all.
I wanted
over
to
again.
Stay here, but you know, Campbell just, you know, and obviously Campbell thought he had me where he wanted me, and that I wasn't going to be able to go anywhere because the whole collusion thing was based on nobody was going to offer any free agents any contracts. So he knew that nobody was going to offer me anything and he could give me whatever he wanted. So rather than give me the extension that we all had agreed on, he backtracked and dumped a one-year deal on me for the same amount of money that I'd made the year before. And I just said, not doing it.
Good for you.
And I said, you know what? I cannot believe you're treating me like this. Yeah. I said, I've done everything you've asked me to do. And I've tried to represent this organization in the best way I can. And this is the thanks I get. I said, if anybody offers me anything, I'm leaving. Yeah. I said, not because I want to, because I just feel that strongly about the way you're handling this. So.
And the Phillies did. Yeah.
The Phillies did.
And just no loyalty.
And just so people are aware, Gary Carter's a Hall of Fame catcher. Okay. And he's a really good catcher. Don't get me wrong. Lance Parrish, 8 All-Stars. Gary Carter, 9. Lance Parrish, 6 Silver Sluggers. 3-time Gold Glove. All right. Gary Carter, 3-time Gold Glove. And 5 Silver Sluggers. So Lance has got one more Silver Slugger. Carter's got one more All-Star. Same Gold Gloves. I've already gone over the number of home runs, RBIs, runs scored. I'm not saying Lance is better than Gary Carter. I'm saying Lance is in the same class as Gary Carter.
Meaning that he should be in the Hall of Fame.
I've said it for a long time. I'm not being a homer. I don't say that because I love Lance Parrish and because he's a friend and because he's here. I've said this for a long time. I've said it about Mickey Lolich. I've said it about Lou Whitaker. And I've also said it about Bill Freehand, which is, you know, it's probably not as strong of an argument, but I get it. But I think the Tigers should be fighting more for their own anyway.
And well, you got a chance to obviously play with Tram and Lou and Gibby.
Yeah.
What was it like in 2003 joining the coaching staff and coaching with those guys?
It's great.
What do you remember most about it?
Well, first of all, you know, I know you asked me something about Lou not too long ago, Lou Ann Allen. You know, just let me say this about Lou. Lou was the best natural hitter I've ever seen.
I've seen Lou
wow. come into spring training without ever picking up a bat during the offseason and get in there against guys throwing live BP and just rake. Like, you know, he'd been doing it for, you know, the last month. And I was, that was just always like, I couldn't fathom that. Mm. You know, he was on time. He was, you know, hitting the ball everywhere, just like nothing ever happened. We had an incident during one of those years. It might have been 84, but it was around 84, where he got upset with our hitting coach. I don't know who it was at the time, or the way something was going down. So he said, you know what? I'm not taking batting practice anymore. I'm showing up for the game and I'm playing, you know? And I think Sparky was, you know, smart enough to just let Lou do what he wanted to do. Well, I think Lou led the team in hitting from that point on to the rest of the season without ever taking batting practice. I mean, that pissed me off. I was happy that he was contributing.
Yeah, I don't believe
but, you know, he and Lou, just a great combination, two great human beings. You know, they obviously learned to work very well together and were the cornerstone of our ball club. I mean, you know, Lou and Allen, defensively, offensively. We, you know, fast forward to the again to the World Series in 84. It's Lou and Allen leading things off. And it's like Lou was on, Allen was on. Lou was on, Allen was on. It was like, you know, I had my best year in 83.
Yeah.
I had 114 RBIs, I think, which was the only time I ever had 100 RBIs. Came close. I had 98 2 years in a row. But I think back to 1983, and I had Lou and Allen in front of me. They both had good years. I should have had 190 RBIs, you know, as often as they were on base. So they definitely did their job in setting the table for guys like me and Gibby and Daryl and all that. So can't say enough good things about them. And do I think Lou should be in the Hall of Fame? Absolutely. There's just, it boggles my mind, you know, the criteria that's involved and the decision-making that's involved, how, you know, and you bring up WAR. I honestly don't know what the formula for WAR is, but I heard somewhere along the way that there was a bunch of Hall of Famers that had, you know, whatever their WAR numbers was. Mm-hmm. Well, Lou had a higher WAR number than all of them.
I know.
Second baseman. And,
right.
And they're all in the Hall of Fame, and he's not.
Yeah, he's got a higher WAR than most second basemen.
Yeah.
Well, Shep definitely knows the formula. What's the formula for the
WAR? Well, we don't have to get caught up in wins above replacement, but I would say this. Lou Whitaker has a higher WAR.
Yeah.
He's got better numbers than most of the Hall of
Fame. Big-time Hall of Fame.
Yes, and I have had this, I'll call it a debate. It's probably more of an argument, but that's okay. A debate with national writers. And I've asked them about you and about Whitaker. And they said, well, we just didn't see them that much. And I said, well, that's on you. That's not on the player. Shame on you for getting caught up in New York and Boston and Los Angeles. How could you not have seen them over their careers just because they weren't on Monday Night Baseball, which was pretty cool back then, but now you see them all the time.
Sure.
I never understood it. And that's why I feel like there's probably a lot of people who shouldn't have a vote. It's as nice as I can say it. There's a lot of people who vote for baseball Hall of Famers have no business voting for them. Because I want you to think about this for a second.
Second that.
There's somebody out there. Think about that. There's somebody out there who actually said, Ken Griffey Jr., not today. Somebody actually said that.
Like, come on.
Like, it's stupid, yeah. Okay? But, you know, we can have the debate. I'm just saying, I think you can make a really strong argument for Lance Parrish and Lou Whitaker, and I'm willing to do that with anybody who wants to challenge it.
Well, so, I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't want to toot my own horn here, but, and I'll only say this about, you know, they've got a zillion things on Facebook and social media. So a buddy of mine sent me a little blurb that was on Facebook, I think. And it was a statistical thing about there's 7 catchers in the Hall of Fame that have caught over 1,000 games. I think it was 1,000 games, 1,500 games, whatever it was. Have over 300 home runs and have over 1,000 RBIs. 6 of them are in the Hall of Fame. And the only one that isn't is you.
Yeah, right.
So I go, well, I got that going for me.
You well, know, I used to say this. If you're going to be in the Hall of Fame, you have to be at least consider the best of your era. Okay? And in the 1980s, we're looking at guys like Rick Cerrone, nice enough guy, I'm sure, but wasn't you. Bob Boone was a really good catcher.
Yes, he was.
Okay. Gary Carter, as we mentioned. Rick Dempsey, good broadcaster and a really good guy. Carlton Fisk, one of the gold standards. That's okay. Mike Socha, Daryl Porter, Tony Pena. I mean, come on. I'm kind of, you know, you're kind of answering the, I think I'm answering my own question before I even ask it, but it's pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious.
Well, you know, there's another thing that was thrown out there, you know, and I always prided myself in my throwing.
Yes.
You know, that was my job to stop the running game, right?
Yeah.
So Ricky Henderson was, you know, number one on my list. You know, he was the guy. If I could stop him, it was like a huge accomplishment for me. I looked forward to the matchup. I couldn't wait to play the A's because I wanted the chance to throw Ricky out.
How many chances did you get?
Quite a few, actually.
Where you were successful against him.
I was.
He was.
As a matter of fact, I threw him out more than anybody else in baseball.
Whoa.
According to what I've heard. I don't look all this up and verify it, but that statistic was brought to my attention. I did not have the highest percentage throwing him out. That was Bob Boone. But I did throw him out more times than anybody else in baseball. So,
and do you think that's because of the pop time, how quickly you got rid of the
ball? He made me change my throwing mechanics. He was just that good. I mean, I had a strong arm. I could throw. And I always thought I was pretty quick getting rid of the ball. But I was not quick enough to get him, which pissed me off. You know, I'd catch the ball and come up, boom, you know, boom. And put it right on the bag, and he'd beat it. And I just thought, how is that possible? I mean, I can't do it any faster than that. So what I did, rather than shuffle my feet like most catchers do nowadays, I just left my back. I would stagger my stance and put my right foot behind, you know, behind a little bit. I wouldn't have my feet square. I'd be out this way. So my plant foot was dropped back a little bit. And I would just catch the ball and come up and throw. You know what I mean? I wouldn't shuffle my feet. I mean, I figured there's no other way possible for me to quicken my time other than just eliminate the footwork part of it. Just catch the ball and come up and throw it, you know? And then I started getting them a little more often. In fact, I recall twice in Tiger Stadium, you know, remember Short Dog, you know, out there dancing, doing all this thing. Well, you know, he used to do me favors. And the way that they groomed the infield, it was pretty hard surface, and they put that stuff they put on that dries up the moisture and whatnot. And it made it like a slip and slide sometimes. And twice in the same game, Ricky Henderson beat my throw to second base by a millimeter, it seemed like. But he slid past the bag, and Tram or Lou, whoever got it, was able to tag him when he went by the bag. That's so awesome. I got credit for caught stealing right there. I was like, yeah. So the ground crew helped me out in that regard a couple times. But he was number one nemesis, boy. He was amazing. Greatest leadoff guy ever.
Without a doubt.
Who's the greatest player you've ever played against?
Woo. Well, I got a chance to play with Junior in Seattle. He was pretty amazing. When I went to Philadelphia, I got to play with Mike Schmidt. He was always high on my list, as you know. And then when I was in Anaheim, you know, I never wanted to leave the Tigers, but these teams that I played for, there's some great guys on the teams that I played. When I went to Anaheim, we had Winfield and Dave Parker in the same lineup.
That's pretty awesome.
Which was awesome. Twin Towers. And, you know, Parker was a riot. You know, God rest his soul, just a great human being. And loved being around him. He was so much fun. I remember Muhammad Ali came into the locker room one day, you know, and he was, you know, not doing real well. You know, he didn't talk a whole lot. But he came in and he wanted to say hi to everybody. And, you know, Parker was like a little kid in a candy store. You know, he's dancing around. Hey, champ, hey, champ, you know. And, you know, he's, you know, thinking like, you know, and I'm just thinking, he's going to turn around and just pop you right in the nose. So, you know, he's looking at him, you know, Parker's going on and on. And he looked at him finally and he goes, man, he goes, you're ugly. He goes, you remind me of Joe Frazier. And Parker got the biggest kick out of it. He's like, ah, he just started laughing.
Oh, that's and, oh, so funny. So it was
did you and Winfield ever talk about football since he was an unbelievable athlete?
Well, he was unbelievable at everything.
Yeah.
He was just a great athlete.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just you know, he had obviously an opportunity to play professionally in everything.
I yeah, three sports. Yep. Drafted in three sports. Yeah.
I seen him hit some home runs, man. Boom. As soon as he hit it, it was gone. Line drives in Yankee Stadium, right center, left center. I mean, when he connected, it was like a rocket.
Violent swing, right?
Yeah.
What were the conversations like with you and batters standing in the box? Did you ever have them?
I didn't talk to the batters.
No? Why not?
You know, I always used to get grief from my coaches. You know, why don't you talk to those guys? Well, I go, I'm concentrating on my job. You know, I'm not up there to have a conversation with these guys. Or, you know, I mean, there were guys that I got to know that I, over the years that I, you know, Robin Yount would always, he would always come up to the plate and look at me and he goes, if we get in a fight, he goes, it's me and you. He goes, I'm going to kick your ass. You know, so I'd have to hear that every time he came up. And, you know, I talked to other guys periodically, just, you know, say, hey, I never had any real conversations with anybody. In fact, I didn't even like talking to the umpires because I was not a big fan of most of the umpires. I just felt like they were so inconsistent. And, obviously, there were some good ones, and I'll let them try to figure out who they are. But there was a lot of guys that I, you know, sitting back there all those years, it was like, oh, my gosh, you know, could you be any more inconsistent than this? It was just amazing to me. So actually, back in those days, I felt the umpires had free rein to call anything they wanted a strike, you know, and they were not held accountable for it. Nowadays, they've got, you know, the box on the TV and the Quest Tech and everybody, you know, checks them and double checks them. And you can actually do something about it. If they have consistently bad reports or, you know, they're at the bottom of the heap, you know, they can send them to AAA or kick them out. Back in those days, there was no recourse at all. You know, they could call every pitch on you that was a ball, a strike, and at the end of the day, they could throw you out and you get fined and nothing happens to them. And I even said that one time on the air, and I got in trouble for it.
Well, thinking of strikeouts, you know, we're talking about throwing strikes. Have you got a chance to watch Tarek Skubal? How much have you watched?
Well, you know, I actually got to manage Tarek Skubal in West Michigan for a very short period of time. They teased me with Tarek Skubal because at the end of the year, we were making a run for the playoffs, and we had signed Tarek, and he worked his way up, and we got him. And it was like, I remember Willie Blair was my pitching coach, and he's like, this guy's special. And I'm like, he is special. And he's going to help us a lot. Well, a couple weeks into the deal, I get a phone call, and it's like, Skubal's done. Don't let him throw anymore. And I'm like, what? I go, you know, we're making a run at the play. He's done. He's pitched in college. He's got enough pitches now. You know, the decision's been made to shut him down, not let him pitch anymore. I was like, oh, my gosh. But you could see back then that he had something special.
How hard was that for you? Because you were grew up in an era and played in an era where pitchers went deep into games, much deeper. I mean, it was a prideful thing to complete a game.
You're five and you don't see them.
Now it's six and you're done.
I mean, obviously it's a change in philosophy. You know, I assume I would always look to Jack because he never wanted to come out of the game. He didn't care how many pitches he threw. You know, it was almost like, don't count how many pitches I'm throwing. I'll let you know when I'm done. And I remember a few times he was well up into the 150s and whatever, you know, and just another day at the office for him. Nowadays, it's, you know, they're so concerned about everybody's health. And, you know, they're going to hurt their arm or, you know, Nolan Ryan. Nolan Ryan was the same way. I just read something recently on online where Nolan Ryan pitched a game where he threw 238 pitches or something. I'm like, I didn't even know that.
Because he walked a lot that game.
Huh?
Because he walked a lot of batters that game.
Well, whatever the case, still 238 pitches.
Yeah.
So you talk about having an iron mentality and a rubber arm. I mean, he was amazing himself.
How was that conversation on the mound when you go to the mound with Sparky and listen to Sparky and Jack Morris talk about? Because Jack never, you're right, Jack never won.
Jack never wanted anybody to come out and talk to him, period. No. You know, and even, you know, they would tell me, you need to go out and talk to Jack, you know, every once in a while. I go, he didn't want to talk to me. He didn't want to hear what I have to say.
Jack told me. You know? Jack didn't want anybody coming out messing with him.
You know, so when we would go out there, and when we got Daryl, for example, you know, Daryl was just the freaking instigator. Same with Tram. So they would go out there and they would just, you know, just trying to get Jack riled up, you know, and get him fired up, and you know, call him a baby, and you know, you this and you that, nah, you know. So you know, it actually, I don't know if it served to motivate him or what, but he always seemed to rise to the occasion after those meetings. So they were pretty good at needling him and you know, getting him refocused. Maybe that was their objective. I don't know.
So he didn't have no good fight with Sparky though,
huh?
Because Sparky laid down the hammer. He said Jack didn't have much. I mean, any arguments?
Hey, when Sparky laid the law down, you know, Gibby can very, you know, he can attest to that as well. You know, Sparky along the way when Gibby first came up, Sparky called him in his office and you know, telling him you know the what fors and you know this is how it's going to be. And I think according to what I heard, you know, the way the story went, Gibby jumped up and you know started screaming at him as only Gibby can.
Exactly.
You know. And Sparky just sat there like,
what are you going to do?
You done?
Yeah.
And he goes, so just let me tell you this, you know, without changing his look at all, you will sit right next to me on the bench until you figure out who's running this show. Enough said. Get out of here. And that's what he did. And I know it drove Kirk out of his mind, but I think he got the message.
He got the message.
And that's the way he dealt with everybody. Mm. I think when he came on board when Campbell brought him in to replace my guy, Les Moss. I think the stipulation was I get to run this the way I want to run it. Mm-hmm. And you know that's just the way it is. If that's not the way it's going to be, then I'll look elsewhere.
You shared a great story about getting a phone call. Was it after the no-hitter? And it was... It took the person on the other end of the line a little while to figure out who they were talking to. Can you share that
actually,
with the audience? Yeah, it's in the book.
I think
yeah.
I mentioned that.
You do. Yeah, that's where I got it.
Well, you know, we had a celebration on the field. Excuse me. We were celebrating on the field. Everybody's jumping around. You know, we took the celebration into the clubhouse, you know, and everybody's, you know, still excited and, yeah, you know, it's loud in there. All the coaches were out there with everybody at Comiskey. And the phone rings in Sparky's office. There's one little office tucked away in the corner. That's Sparky's office. And nobody was there. Well, one of the clubhouse kids, who was just a young teenager, I would imagine, and didn't know any of us, and the season had just started anyway. Right. So he went in and answered the phone, and it was Jim Campbell. And he identified himself, said he wanted to speak with Jack Morris. And the kid goes, yeah, okay. So he goes out in the clubhouse. Now, he don't know anybody, okay? And I'm sure by that time, a lot of guys had taken their jerseys off because it was after the game. And I just happened to be standing, I think, in front of Jack Morris's locker. So he comes up and taps me on the shoulder, and he goes, you have a phone call in Mr. Anderson's office. And I go, phone call? I go, who is it? And he goes, somebody named Mr. Campbell. And I just perked up like, oh, okay. So I was like, wow, this is amazing. So I went into the office and picked up the phone, and sure enough, it's Jim Campbell on the other end. And he's like, as excited as I've ever heard him in my life, you know, and I almost had to sit there and listen to make sure it was actually Jim Campbell. And he was just going off about, oh my God, what a game. And he goes, you know, our organization is so proud of you and you did such a great job. And, you know, the whole state of Michigan, the whole town of Detroit, you know, just, you know, going on and on. And I'm just sitting there with a big smile on my face, like, wow, this is like amazing. You know, and my way of thinking was, when a guy throws a no-hitter, I realize that he's the one that's going to get all the accolades, and rightly so. I mean, he's the guy that threw the no-hitter. But for my general manager and president of the ball club, I guess he was the president then, to call me up and congratulate me and give me some kudos on the job I did, I thought, man, it doesn't get any better than this, right? So I'm just eating it up. Oh, yeah, thank you. You know, that's so nice. And he goes, hey, there's going to be a little something extra for you in your next paycheck. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, how cool is that? You know, so I'm going, thank you. So, you know, he goes on a little bit more, and then he goes, yeah, when you struck that last guy out, I about fell off my – and I go, wait. I go, when I struck that last guy out, I go, who do you think you're talking to? And he goes, well, who is this? And I said, well, it's Lance. He goes, well, what the hell are you doing on the phone? I go, well, the clubhouse guy came out and got me and said you wanted to talk to me. And he goes, well, I don't want to talk to you. I wanted to talk to Jack. You know, and then he started getting on me like I did it on purpose or something, you know. So I'm just like, you got to, and I mean, he was relentless, you know. First he couldn't say enough nice things. Then he's like all over me for, you know, picking up the phone. So I was like, well, you son of a gun. So he goes, just go get Jack. I go, all right, all right. I go, what? So I all of a sudden, I just got a little flash in my head, and I go, what? Is there still going to be a little something? He goes, get the hell off the phone and go get Jack. So I was like, all right, that's it. So I took the phone, I slammed it down on the desk, and I walked out the office, and I closed the door, and I never did get Jack. I thought, I hope he sits on that phone for an hour waiting for Jack to show. But Jack did eventually talk to him, and he did get a little something extra, which I never saw any of.
Oh, my God. You're kidding me. He didn't get – oh, that's terrible.
And I rag him about that every once in a while. And you know why I do? Because I saw most recently – I guess Spencer Turnbull was the last guy to throw a no-hitter for the Tigers. And I heard on one of the broadcasts that Spencer Turnbull bought I don't know who was catching, Alex or somebody, a brand-new Rolex watch. Yeah. And I'm thinking, freaking Jack never got me nothing. He didn't even take me out to dinner.
So, not even a case of beer. Do you get tired of talking about 1984?
No.
Okay, good.
Hey, good. It's the greatest year of my life in professional baseball. So how could you get tired? And it was a great year. Yeah. I mean, look at all the things that we accomplished. 35-5, 17-0, to start the season on the road. I mean, every year I find myself watching, if somebody gets off to a good start, I'm thinking, could this be the year that, you know, and they'll start to get, 18-2 or... And I go, well, they still got to go 17-3 or something. And I'm thinking, there ain't no way. Then all of a sudden, they'll put a string of losses together. And it's like, okay, we're safe for another year.
It's like almost
year.
The 72 Dolphins, you know, all to a certain extent.
Exactly.
Yeah, 53 home wins, 51 road kills for that team and with 104 wins. And really never a doubt against Kansas City, who was a good baseball team.
Well, just let me say this.
Okay.
Earlier in the year, before the season was over, we played a four-game series against Kansas City in Detroit, and they swept us. So don't think that we were taking them lightly when we got to the playoffs. Mm-hmm. You know, you can never underestimate the Royals. You know, they had just had a great attack, and whenever they were hitting on all cylinders, they were tough to stop. So we knew we had our work cut out. So I was happy and impressed and all the above, everything, that we were able to do the things that we did, you know, just completely shut them down and play the way we did against them. But we were on a mission too. So, you know, I thought it was very telling of the kind of ball club and makeup that we had, that we play the way we did in the postseason.
What was the level of surprise that you had faced San Diego instead of Chicago? Because everybody thought it was going to be you guys in the Cubs.
To be honest with you, I was hoping we played Chicago. You know, I just thought it would have been a better, just a better story. But, you know, and all I've heard about, you know, going up to that was, you know, the last time they played in the series against the Cubs and all that. So I thought, well, it's, you know, going to be a kind of a reunion here against them. Well, and I actually, personally speaking, thought the Cubs had a better team. And I often wonder, would it have been a different outcome if we did play the Cubs? I mean, they had a good team.
Yeah.
They had a good team. You know, but obviously – the Padres beat them, so they had to have a good team as well. And, you know, we just were able to, you know, rise to the occasion. And I'll tell you what, the difference, you know, if you look at the breakdown of those games, we destroyed their starting pitching. You know, their bullpen actually shut us down, with the exception of that one inning that Goose threw, where Gibby took him deep and I took him deep. And, you know, it was but, you know, all the games before that, when they brought the bullpen in, man, they just slammed the door. We couldn't get anything. But we destroyed their starting staff. So that was and that was the Lewin Allen attack, you know, leading things off every
especially
game.
Especially Mark Thurman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was one of those big moments that you just it lives in your head forever? It'll be in your head forever. Like, I know you don't like to talk about yourself, but there was gotta be one moment that you had, like there was an at bat, maybe it was throwing somebody out, in a big moment that you'll never forget.
Well, there's a few of them, actually. You know, the day that I got my very first hit, in the big leagues. It was pretty special.
Who'd you get it off of?
Well, Ed Farmer, who I think I hit my first home run off of. Now I say I can't even remember. Earl Stevenson and Ed Farmer were, I got my first hit off of one of them and my first home run off of the other one. So I don't know. But I ended up going 3-for-4 that day with, I think, 4 RBIs and 3 or 4 runs scored. And I hit my first home run. And it was the second game that I had played professionally. My mom and dad were in the stands. Wow. So, up to, you know, leading up to my last at bat, I was 3-for-3 in that game. I had a single, a double, and a home run. If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong.
Going for the cycle.
Yeah. And the last time when I came up, in fact, I think it was a single, double, and home run because I think I had a bases clearing double, my second hit, or one of my hits. And then the next time I got up, I was 3-for-3 with all these RBIs and everything. And the people in the stadium gave me a standing ovation. How about that? Second game in the big league. So I was like, wow. And I flew out to the track in right center. So I could have really had a monster game. But that was a great game. The All-Star game in Montreal, which I'll never forget. I mean, I set a record for throwing out, and it might still stand. I don't even know. But at the time, I had set a record for the most guys thrown out attempting to steal in an All-Star game. And the only guy to steal off me, I was 3-1, was Tony Pena.
Oh, no.
And Frank White, when he came in from second base, he goes, he was out. And I go, figures. I go, you know, I thought he was out. He goes, he was out.
Yeah.
You know, so I could have had 4 guys. But I think it was Steve Sachs, Ozzie Smith, and I can't remember the last guy. But, you know, that was great. And I hit a double off the wall, off right center, off of Mario Soto. And I made a running catch of a pop foul that was way over by
the
dugout.
How'd you not win MVP of that game?
Huh?
How'd you not win MVP of that
game? Well, we lost the game, and somebody else on the other side had a pretty good game, too. I don't even remember who was the MVP. Wow. But, you know, I had some guys come up to me in our clubhouse and go, you should have been the MVP of the game. And I go,
that's pretty cool.
That would have been cool.
What about the World Series? That has to be.
Well,
the World
Series. I mean, nothing tops that.
Yeah.
I mean, I will always be about, you know, whatever we accomplished as a team. And it just doesn't get any better than that. That was the culmination of an amazing summer. You know, I felt like I had worked my absolute butt off to get to that point, you know, and be able to finally call myself a world champion. But I will say, and this might sound disrespectful or unappreciative, but I felt the rings they gave us were not worthy of a world championship.
I don't disagree with
you.
Or
the year
either.
We have. And I even put that in the book, too.
They're high school rings.
Yeah.
That's what they are.
You know, and I'll tell you this story that's in the book. So I don't wear my ring, and which, you know, it's just my choice. I'm not a ring person anyway. But I remember wearing my ring, and during the winter, when we got it, I was shopping in a big department store with my wife, you know, buying some clothes. And, you know, we're at the counter and I'm going to write a check. And the girl behind the counter sees my ring and she goes, oh, she goes, what a nice ring. She goes, what school did you go to? And I just went, that's it.
You're not wearing,
I'm not wearing this ring again.
I mean, think about our American League Championship rings.
I know.
They're better than
those rings you guys got.
Yeah.
Incredible.
They're better than the World Series champions.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean,
that was Jim Campbell, though, you know.
Just tight.
You know, Dan Petrie, I remember Dan Petrie was representing us at the time. He was our player rep. And Campbell called him up into his office to discuss the ring design. So we were going, hey, dude, step up, man. Let's go. And so when he came back, he goes, the only choice I got to make was, do you want a black stone in there or a blue stone?
That was it.
You know, huh? And that was it. He didn't have anything else to say about the design. So I was just, you know, and it wasn't only the, you know, I just feel like a ring represents, and, you know, Tram, you know, being Tram and very diplomatic, when I talk to him about what I said in the book, he goes, you know, I get the whole ring thing. And he goes, but I've gotten beyond that. He goes, it's for me, it's what it represents. I go, well, Tram, it's always about what it represents.
Yeah.
I go, I agree with you. But, you know, I just felt like that, you know, Campbell was a big cheapskate. and that
which is true
for the year that we had, we should have a ring that represented 35-5 and wire to wire and the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. And I said, I just, you know, just didn't think it was worthy. Plus, they chintzed some guys out.
Bill Scherzer.
Billy Shear.
Completely. Yeah. Right. I think it was made of glass. It wasn't diamonds.
You're right.
Yeah.
Because I went with him and Vern Plegenhoff, who was the guy that put him up to it, because he wanted to write a story on the ring when we got it. Yeah. And Billy Shear, you know, left-handed relief pitcher, never took his ring off after we got him on the, you know, opening day. Wore it in the shower, you know, it was always on his hand. Well, after a while, you noticed that his fingers started turning green.
Oh, you know? No way.
So everybody's looking at him like, hey, man.
That's awful.
Something ain't right about that ring. So Vern Plegenhoff got wind of that. So he's, you know, I'm writing a story on this ring. And he goes, he went up to Billy in Minnesota, said, I will take you out to lunch if you'll come downtown with me. There's a jewelry store right down the street. And let the guy appraise, and I'll pay for everything. The appraisal, I'll buy you lunch. And Billy's like, nah, I don't want to do that. So, you know, he finally talked him into it. I go, come on, let's go. You know, what the heck? What do you care? Free lunch out of the deal. I'll go with you. So we go down there and we walk in the store and it's the jeweler. Just nobody else was in there at the time. And he comes over and, you know, can I help you? And Vern goes, excuse me, man. He says, we just want to get a
ring appraisal.
Of this ring. So the guy goes, it's a World Series ring. You know, Tigers won the World Series. This is, I'm doing a story on it. Just want to get some idea what its value is. So he takes it off his finger and he gives it to him. And he's got one of them little things that he's looking at it. And he's looking. And he goes, are you sure you want me to do this? And we're like, well, yeah. And he goes, well, first of all, he goes, this isn't a real diamond that's in here. You know, because there's one diamond in the middle of the ring. So it wasn't a real diamond. It wasn't real gold. You know, it was just like a $200 or $300 ring, basically.
That is crazy.
So, and Vern wrote an article about it, and Campbell got some kind of pissed, you know, that he would have the audacity to write an article about, you know. So his justification for it was, you know, the players always have shares meetings, and they, you know, vote on shares on how much playing time anybody got, if they were there the whole year, blah, blah, blah. He goes, so that's what I did with the rings. If you weren't there for a whole year, you didn't get the top quality ring. You got a lesser quality ring. And it's like everybody in baseball, if you played,
a game, two days.
You contributed at all and the team won the World Series, you got a ring because you were part of it, which is awesome, I think, you know. Hey, thanks for your contribution. Here's a ring, you know, something to remember. Well, Campbell did. There was guys that he did not even give a ring to, and there was Billy Shear who got, you know, a $100 ring or whatever the heck it cost. So I think in the end of the article, when Campbell got done unloading, his famous comment was, well, this too shall pass. That was his, you know.
I used to get kind of ridiculed a little bit. I said on an anniversary, they should redo and give them all new rings. Was what I always thought they should do. I mean, think about it. It's the greatest team in Tigers history. I know there's an affiliation for
the 68 team
and 35-45, but 84 was really special. Before we let you go, you guys did have ups and downs. Every team does. At the time of this speaking, the Tigers have lost 9 of 10.
Yeah.
They are 14-18 in their last 32. They have not played good baseball. How do you keep a team on the right track when they're going wayward during a season that appears to be special?
Just keep grinding. You know, I think they've learned a lot about themselves the last year or so. You know, at the end of last year, they obviously got hot and carried it into the playoffs. And I think that became a defining moment for them that, hey, you know, I think we're better than we think we are. We're further along than we think we are. And, you know, for me, it was like, okay, well, you got hot at the end of the year. Let's see how you do next year. Well, this is next year. And they started off, like, amazing, and they've been playing amazing. And best record in baseball. Okay, so they've lost, you know, 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 or whatever. And it's been a rough stretch, but it's like, you know what? If you're as good as you think you are, then you'll find a way to overcome this and snap out, which I'm sure they will. At least, you know, as a Tiger fan, we all hope they will. I know AJ has done a great job up to this point, as well as his coaches. And I think they will find a way to get that fire, you know, burning underneath them again. And I think they'll turn it around. I don't think that having the best record in baseball going into the All-Star break was a fluke. And it even happened later this year than normally, doesn't it? I mean, they almost were at 100 games at the All-Star break.
Yeah, their 59 wins are tied for most in franchise history at the All-Star break. Yeah. So that tells you
something. So, I'm curious to see if they'll do anything. Any additions?
A bigger bat in the middle, maybe?
I think a bat would be
third baseman.
I'm not going to, you know. I do think that a bat, I don't care where it goes, but a big bat in that lineup would get people healthy again. You know, the people that are on the DL. I mean, that's one of the things that I found out in 84, and you know that as well as I do. If you have a great team, you got to keep healthy. You got to keep your horses healthy. So we were very fortunate in 84. I know Tram went down for a little while. He had a arm deal going on. But, you know, we picked up the slack when he was out. And when he got back in, he just slid right back into where he was. Jack had a little bit of a hiccup along the way. But for the most part, everybody just, stayed healthy and did great.
Your best ability is your availability.
We're brought to you by Imagine at the Palladium here in Birmingham. So we always ask a movie question before we say goodbye. Ooh. What's your favorite sports movie of all time?
Oh,
that's a good one.
Well, ironically, I'm not going to say that this is my favorite movie, but when we were on the airplane flying from Detroit to San Diego to start the World Series, they had, what's the movie with Robert Redford when he hit the light tower?
Oh, The Natural.
The Natural. We were watching The Natural. I don't know if that was an attempt to motivate everybody. It's when the movie came out anyway. I don't know. I haven't watched any of these movies for the longest time, but the baseball movie that I love Rudy. Everybody loves Rudy. You know, it's kind of an underdog movie, and it's fun to watch him. And he did a great job. They did a great job making that. But the Kevin Costner baseball movie.
Oh,
for the love of the game.
No, not for the love
no?
of the game. Bull Durham. When I saw that, I go, that is 100% what the minor leagues are like. I mean, I live that, so I could totally identify with all of that went on. I mean, they did a great job putting that together. And, and I say that ironically, later on in my career, when I was at the end of the road, more or less, and I was trying to hang on, wanting somebody to give me an opportunity, I went to spring training with the Dodgers. And I thought for sure I was going to make. I had a great spring, honestly. I mean, I couldn't have played much better than I played. But they had a guy by the name of Mike Piazza or something.
Yeah, there, that guy.
And he had an amazing spring. Yeah. I mean, when Tommy called me into the office and he goes, I love you. He goes, but we've made a decision to go with Mike. And I go, well, I don't blame you. Oh. I said, I watched him just like you did. And I go, it's amazing. Yeah. I go, I don't think I've ever seen anybody have a better spring training than he had. And they had another catcher by the name of Carlos Hernandez, who was already a part of that team that had taken over for Socha the year before when Socha went down. And he was on the team no matter what. So it was actually going to be me and him. And my agent goes, there's no way Tommy will take two rookie guys or two young catchers to start the season. He goes, so you're a lock. You're in. Well, I wasn't a lock. And obviously Mike proved his worth. He was just a great catcher. But
he's a great hitting catcher.
Huh?
Yes. He's a great hitting catcher.
He can swing it.
Yeah. I mean, defensively, he was an unbelievable, maybe the greatest offensive catcher of all time, but defensively a little bit of a liability. Did you ever get bothered a little bit by the fact that so many people associate the offensive numbers with catcher? Today it's a little different, but back when you played, I mean, Jim Sundberg was a really good defensive catcher, for example, for Texas, but he wasn't a great offensive player. How did you weigh the two sides of what a catcher's responsibility is?
Well, I was always told that defense comes first. In fact, I had guys, was my voice again, excuse me, I had guys in our own clubhouse that, you know, I would get pissed if I had a bad game offensively and we won, which was very selfish of me. But, you know, I wanted to contribute in all facets of my game. So from the very beginning, I had guys coming up to me going, you don't worry about what you do offensively. Your number one priority is defense, handling this pitching staff and catching a good game. If you have a great offensive game, great. But priority-wise, catching defense is number one. And I took that to heart. And I had other guys, even coaches, tell me that. So, but I had an awful lot of pride in my offense, obviously. That's I wanted correct. To be a contributor offensively. So I worked, you know, tirelessly to try to be as good offensively as I could. And, you know, I've been asked my opinion of Dylan Dingler and Jake Rogers. Both outstanding defensive catchers. Great arms. They both throw well. They both call a good game. I've you know, given Jake big kudos about the way he handles the pitching staff and his leadership qualities. But you know what? At the end of the day, the guy that swings the bat consistently is the guy that's going to get the most playing time. That's just the way it is. So if you've got two guys of equal talent playing the same position, you know, if you're swinging the bat, if you're raking, you're in the lineup. That's just the way it is, you know. So,
well, you did it as well as any catcher in the history of the franchise. 324 career homers, over 1,000 RBIs. You can make the argument he should be in the Hall of Fame. The Enchanted Season by Lance Parrish is available for you anywhere you get your books, and you can make sure you can order it today because it's a really fun and a really good read.
It's a fun read.
Yeah, it really is.
Thank you.
You and Tom Gage did a great job with that. Lance, well, thanks for joining us here on Catching Up with Simo and Shep. We'll talk to you down the road. Okay, bye.
You bet. Right. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.